nothing.
Okay.
All right.
Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Thanks for joining us, everybody. My name is Jamie, and we have Jerry here, and we have Chris as well.
Hey, what's up?
So all the Movie Geeks are here. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing pretty well. I was just listening to that music. It is ridiculous. That opening music is absolutely preposterous.
Why do you think that?
I think we need to take a look at that.
I think we could use, on my MySpace page, I have the one of the theme from the original Italian Job movie. We could use that. I think that would be better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's some sort of copyright issue with doing that for a radio show, but you know, maybe we got to make something up. I'm not a musician, but I think we can come up with something cooler than that. It sounds like a porno movie from the 30s or something.
From the 30s? Wow, man, that's really bad.
Man, I didn't know they had electric guitars in the 30s.
Of course, sure they did. Sure they did.
They had something back then, but wow, from the 30s though. Oh my God.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. It's ridiculous. I'm going on record with that right now. I hope there's someone out there that's going to support me on that.
Okay.
You got support for me. I mean,
it is a copyright issue. I got royalty free music, and that was the best of the bunch.
Could we use the Benny Hill theme?
Yeah, like or the Super Mario Brothers music or
there
something.
There you go.
That is just terrible.
Just to let everyone know that might be listening live to this broadcast, everyone's wondering, you know, we had a Tuesday show, and now we have a Friday show at all these odd times. What's going on? Movie Geeks United is still airing every Sunday at 6 o'clock until further notice. But what happened Tuesday was we got invited to be a part of a press junket for Fox Searchlight, and we accommodated their interview schedule. And today we have a special guest who's worked with Al Pacino on several occasions, on three films and several theater workshops as well. And the problem was that our guest list for Sunday night's special tribute was too packed. We didn't have room for another guest. But we desperately wanted to speak to this gentleman. He's a fantastic actor. His name is Richard Cox. And so we accommodated a time today when he was able to call in. And just to let everyone know, this interview will be a special bonus at the end of the broadcast on Sunday for the archive listeners of the show as well. But of course, if you're listening to this, then you haven't missed the live broadcast. So there you go.
All right.
Did I explain it well enough?
I think you did a really good job explaining that and reassuring our listeners that we are still on Sunday nights. But you might want to tell them about the week from Sunday, about the time difference.
Yes, we had a scheduling issue, so our show on next Sunday night, July 1st, will be at 8 o'clock instead of 6. And also, we want to hear from everyone out there if they're were thinking of possibly adding another Movie Geeks United broadcast in the middle of the week. And we want to know what is a convenient time for most people to listen in live. I know we have most of our subscribers are archive listeners, because the 6 o'clock Sunday time is inconvenient for some of them. So if you have any suggestions of times that you think would be perfect for Movie Geeks United to play on Sunday or possibly a Wednesday or Thursday evening as well, just let us know. You know what I think we should do? I think we should play this opening music again and have Chris do some commentary on it.
Well, I was thinking that, or maybe, and even though this contradicts everything I've said the last couple of days, because I'm not a big fan, as we talked the other night on the phone, Jamie, while we're waiting for our guest, any thoughts on the AFI 100 list?
Mm.
Or have I just opened up a can of worms?
Was that a thought or like an emotion you were having there?
Well, I'll tell you.
Any thoughts?
No, I'm just saying, I mean, I don't think too much. I don't give these lists. I don't give the Oscars. I don't give any of this stuff too much credence. But people, I've got several people left comments on my page today. Well, you guys need to talk about this. And
yeah.
It's like, well, no, we need to talk. If we're going to talk about there. Obviously very important issues, what's going on in Gaza right now, what's going on in Iraq, that's important. The AFI list, I put right down there with Steve Carell's bathwater. But,
at the same time, we don't have a show dedicated to the, you know, the Afghanistan or Iraq. It's about movies. So.
I know. I'm just saying, I can't believe there are some people getting really worked up about this, and I just have to say, as we were talking, it's just to get their AFI's popularity there.
Yeah, I mean, it's for ratings. Like, they didn't change that much. Everything, even the new additions, are still pretty predictable. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the switches, there was a little bit of a shift change in where things stood, but not so as you'd notice. You know,
yeah,
Jamie and I were talking about that.
We're trying to get someone, a representative from the AFI, actually on a future show in the near future. When this list is still fresh in everyone's mind, so we can discuss.
Right. Well, that'll be good. I look forward to it.
Yeah, how do you assemble this list? How do you number them? You know, how do you, you know, that's what puzzles me.
Well, they asked critics. They said that on the show, didn't they? They asked so many critics to name their 100 favorites and rank them that way. That's how they did it.
Well, I have a bone to pick with that because I heard AFI members could vote. I'm an AFI member. No one ever called me and said, hey, your vote counts. I mean,
I don't know. I don't know how they get the critics. That I couldn't say.
No, but I mean, you know, I would have, you know, why isn't Porky's on there? Why isn't, you know, Friday the 13th on there? Why isn't Christmas Vacation on there?
Well,
come
I
on,
think
folks.
You just proved why they didn't ask you to.
Well, I'm being flipped. I'm being flipped, my friend. I'm just trying to. I represent everyone in this country. I'm trying to get everyone's voice heard.
I understand.
Well, Jerry, that's what I was telling Jamie, is that we need to each talk about which movies we felt were, you know, like the 3, 4, 5 most important movies that were omitted. You know, obviously not now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I tell you, none of those that I mentioned were ones I really felt that strongly about. But.
No, I didn't think so.
Thank you.
Was Shawshank on there? I didn't even.
Oh yeah, Shawshank.
Yeah, Shawshank's on there.
Okay.
He was in the 30s, I think. I mean, it was pretty.
And
high.
Goodfellas is in the 90s.
Yeah.
Well, that I don't understand that.
That's when that number system doesn't work for me. You know.
Yeah, the number system is ridiculous, and of course, you know, Citizen Kane's always number one.
But I have no problem with that. I mean, it is. You know, I know people like the younger kids. Why is that movie on there about a goddamn sleigh? You know, I understand that, but it is an influential film, and it influences. I think members of each generation that film touched them. I can see that. I have no problem with. The first couple ones listed there, because those films are always, always alluded to, always referenced in current films. There's always a shot. There's always a homage to, like, Citizen Kane or Gone with the Wind in every other film you see today.
Right.
So I have no problem with that. I think what I have a problem with is just, like what we were talking earlier, is just the way it's done. How do you come up with this? What determines why Goodfellas is, like, what was it, in the 90s and... Why the Sixth Sense is higher, I think. I mean...
Right.
Yes,
that I can't answer. But, I mean, as far as Citizen Kane goes, I like the movie, but how long is it going to stay number one? You know, as it gets older and older, is Godfather going to creep into number one after, you know, after all? It used to be number three, and Casablanca was number two. Now Godfather's number two, and I think the next move is for Godfather will creep into number one as Citizen Kane gets older and older, and Casablanca likewise.
Well, I think they do that because they feel sorry for Mr. Wells. I mean, it took a lot of people to get that casket down the stairs. So they feel sorry for him. I mean, you know.
But it's not. Citizen Kane, I do believe, it's not my personal favorite movie. But in terms of the most influential, in terms of the greatest single example of filmmaking, that was ahead of its time.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it is increasingly becoming irrelevant at this point. You know, I mean, every movie is arguably becoming irrelevant, but it's not, you know.
Can I say something? Let me tell you this. Do you want Citizen Kane on as number one, or do you want One Day to Wake Up and see something like 300 as number one?
I'm not saying that I don't like Citizen Kane. I think Citizen Kane is a fine movie, and I definitely am not arguing that it is probably the most influential movie of all time.
No, I understand. It's a common. I understand where the thing is. Like, you know, it's like enough already. We get the point. You know, it's time for someone
right.
else to be put in that spot.
Right.
I understand that. I have no problem with that.
If you are the best, then why would you give up the top spot? Why would you give it to something else that is not?
Well, Citizen Kane's not giving up anything. I mean, but obviously the critics out there agree with you. They vote on which movie is the best, and there's still more critics saying that Citizen Kane is the best movie.
Yeah.
If critics had a say, wouldn't Roger Ebert be getting that one he wrote with Russ Meyer to be number one, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
I mean, wouldn't that be the number one film critics really had their sway? I mean...
Well, but I think they're being, you know, as objective as possible.
No, I know. I realize that.
I don't know. It's just my prediction that eventually that movie will give way, and it's not going to be a newer movie that takes, you know, a current movie that takes it over. You know, we're not going to have another Citizen Kane. Obviously, but I do think that in the next 10 years, or you know, The Godfather is probably going to creep in there to number one.
I wouldn't mind that. Chris, I wouldn't mind that at all. It's just I'm afraid that that won't be the film that takes its place, though.
Oh, really? What would you?
I don't think any of the films in the top 10. I think it. I'm afraid it would be something more recent than that. I would. You know, I know. I mean, as you said very wisely, there are great films being made every decade. But I have a feeling it might be something more current than The Godfather.
You mean like Shawshank, something along those lines?
Yeah.
There's a lot of adoration for that movie.
I love that movie, too, but there's one reason I don't like the movie. People who don't generally go to the movies, if you read any politician's answer what their favorite movie is, they always say Shawshank, always.
Yeah, well.
And it's that it just has that universal...
Well, because Citizen Kane is about a megalomaniac. If you're talking about politicians using movies as part of their platform,
I went to Politician. It's just a Wild Bunch is their favorite movie.
Didn't Clinton say Porky's was his?
And that's why he.
It was, certainly wasn't Wag the Dog. I can tell you that.
No.
Good one. Good one.
Or Primary Colors, for that matter.
My internet connection. Went down again, so I've just reset so I can get the switchboard up.
Okay.
Did Lebowski make the list at all?
Oh, of course not.
Did any of the Coen brothers make the list?
I don't remember. You know, I missed the middle of the show, but I didn't see any on there. I know Fargo. I think Fargo.
No, Fargo
was
not on there.
'90s in 95.
No, Fargo was booted off. I got word of that today. That
Yeah, then I doubt it. I don't know what other movie of theirs they would put on there other than Fargo. You know, on a list that prestigious, I can't see them putting on something like, you know, Raising Arizona or Big Lebowski. Those movies, they all kind of fit into, like, the same sort of category. It's like if you didn't have any food in your pantry, you'd go out and you'd get all the staples and, you know, you'd get the canned food and stuff. If you didn't have any movies in your movie cabinet, you go out and get those 100 movies, that's a pretty good representation of
that's the best
movie of all time.
That's true, and that's actually probably the smartest description I've ever heard of this.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, movies as canned goods, that's good.
No, but as things that you, if you lived on a desert island, if you had nothing, then yeah, that is a good sampling.
Right.
That's very good. In that sense, it's very beneficial then.
Yeah, I mean, there's movies, obviously there's a lot of movies on there I would take on. I mean, what were there, like 3 Chaplin movies on there?
Yeah, the Gold Rush was on there.
Modern Times was
Modern
on
Times.
There. And was The Dictator on there, I think, Little Dictator, is that what it's called?
The Great Dictator.
Yeah.
Great Dictator, yeah, that's what it is.
There's The Duck Soup, the Marx Brothers is on there, so that's always good.
And Night at the Opera was also on
yeah.
there.
Yeah, so. I mean, so you obviously, you have a lot of good things, and a lot of things that are hopefully, the one good thing about the list is some of the older films that are on there, younger people who probably don't watch Turner Classics or something, will go out and, hey, seek those films out. So I have to
right.
say, yes, you know, taking my cynicism aside, you know, yeah, it works. It is beneficial in that way.
I love Chaplin and I love the Marx Brothers even more. But what I'm arguing is there anything that one Marx Brothers film accomplishes that another one is just not repeating? You know, can't you just knock off one of those? I like Duck Soup and Night at the Opera both, but can't you knock, my choice would be to knock Duck Soup off and leave Night at the Opera.
Oh, I'd leave Duck Soup on and knock Night at the Opera, but that's just me. I love the end of that movie. It's hysterical.
Don't get me wrong, they're both great, but isn't it kind of redundant to have two Marx Brothers movies on a list like that where you could take one off and make room for something like Fargo, which I think is pretty
important. Well, now that's a fair thing. I think the Coen brothers need to be represented on there. I mean,
well, we have a call right now from a 301 area code.
It's my neck of the woods.
Let's see what they think. 301, go ahead.
Hey, guys. This is Francis, Jerry Spell.
Hey.
Oh, my God. This is a day that will be long remembered.
I was one of the people cajoling Jerry into talking about the AFI 100, so I felt
it
fair that
it
I call
from.
In and share the misery. So.
Yeah, this is where it comes from, folks. And this guy was he's in the movie. The directors and the producer that we had on last week, and he's also one of my favorite people that I've ever worked with, and just a really good friend, Francis Abbey. You have the floor.
I wasn't expecting an intro, but thank you.
Well, you get an intro with me. You get that. I mean,
so what beef did you have with the AFI list?
Well, you know, I agree with what's been said. I think it's like a great starting point. Like if you're like 10 years ago when this came out, and I was 10 years younger, I hadn't watched, you know, nearly enough movies. So it's a great place to start to, like, get yourself familiar with, like, some classic American cinema, for sure.
Right.
I thought a lot of the movies were, I mean, certainly taking Fargo off the list and having no Coen brothers on there at all is wrong.
Yeah.
The Sixth Sense was included, which is really interesting to me, especially considering, like, how much Shyamalan's stock has dropped in his last couple films.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. And
it has,
it's also
that movie is pretty influential and still is, I think, as far
it
as
it is. I gotta say it's a bit of a coup. I mean, I'm not questioning the quality of the film, but if you look at like the number of films, we're talking about 10 years here, and I was thinking like in the past 10 years,
Heat.
Is there any Heat, for example?
Right.
Oh yeah, I mean,
it would have been a good inclusion.
We talked about that many times at work.
That would have actually been out. Prior, though. That was 95, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. So I think they added, like, at the time of the last list, I think, like, Toy Story and then one other movie were, like, added that had been made prior to that list being created. So
right.
The list was, like, 97, and then, like, Heat had been out, Toy Story had been out.
Yeah.
So,
Well, Francis,
yeah.
Francis, thanks for calling in. Our guest is on the line, so.
Thank you, Francis.
Right,
thank
sure.
you so much.
Cool. Talk to you guys later.
Later.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Cox is here. He's a highly talented and prolific actor whose resume spans more than 30 years. And during that time, he's crafted a series of outstanding film, television, and stage performances. His film credits include Pacino's Looking for Richard, Cruising, and the upcoming Salome Maybe. His impressive television credits include roles on Crossing Jordan, The Closer, Cold Case, Numbers, Without a Trace, ER, Law and Order, hang on, I gotta catch my breath, and countless other landmark shows. He received a Drama Desk Award and Tony Award nominations for his stellar performance on Broadway in 1979's Platinum. He's had the pleasure to work with Pacino on several occasions, 3 times in the films that we just mentioned, and several other times in theater workshops. And now it is our pleasure to welcome to the show a terrific actor, Mr. Richard Cox.
Hi.
Hey. How are you?
Nice to hear your voice. I feel like I've known you for years.
I know. We've been corresponding through email for so long now. It's about time we get to speak. So thanks so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Tell me how, first of all, how you came to meet Pacino for the first time.
Well, the very first time I met him, I was doing a play. I was doing an off-Broadway play, I think, what the heck was it? I was going out with a girl who was playing Vanessa Redgrave's daughter in Lady of the Sea, the Ibsen play, rarely done Ibsen play. And at the time, there was this rumor floating around that there was a workshop that Pacino was doing of the local stigmatic. I think it was about the third time that he'd done it, and it was not publicized, but it was happening at 11 or 12 midnight at the Public Theater. This is a play you probably know about because it's coming out of the box set. It's
right, absolutely.
50 yeah. minutes long, and he was very, very interested in this play for years. He was doing it with John Cassell at the time at close to midnight down at the Public Theater, and I went with Vanessa Redgrave, of all people, as my date. We were all hanging out together because I was going out with this this gal, Alison Argo, played her daughter, and I said, "Hey, I've heard about this," and she said, "I want to go to that," and I said, "Me too." I said, "Well, let's go together." And so I met Al Pacino for the very first time going backstage. We said, "We've got to go backstage," and Vanessa's very down to earth and accessible, and just, you know, that's the kind of thing she would do. So let's go see this workshop together. Mm-hmm. And we went backstage and gave Al a hug and thanked him for his amazing work in that. And I later saw rehearsals of this and then saw, you know, of course, the film, which you've probably seen. Have you seen it?
Yes, yes. I just picked it up. I was so relieved because I've heard about it for so many years. and as a big fan, I just couldn't wait to get my hands on it.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. And you know, it hasn't been released until now, as you know. But
right.
Anyway, a few years later, I found myself cast opposite him in Cruising and went to meet him for the second time backstage at Richard III, which he was doing on Broadway. Little did I know I'd be in Looking for Richard, you know, a few years later.
Right.
I was quite sure he would want to rehearse. We were playing alter egos in this film, Cruising. As you know, he was the cop and I was the killer. And the way it was originally written, and which really intrigued all of us, you kind of knew who the killer was from the beginning, and you knew the cop and the killer, and you watched them come together. At some point, a decision was made to make it more of a murder mystery, and a lot of the stuff where you see the killer at the beginning hit the cutting room floor. Actually, they were looking for it.
Yeah, I wanted
wildly that. Lately because they were coming out with a DVD and they couldn't find it. Something happened when it was, I guess, went from Lorimar to Warner Brothers or whatever, and they were not preserving films so carefully in those days, and nobody could find it. But
right.
There were all sorts of footage of me and Al. That scene on the park bench went on much, much longer. It was almost like a little Pinter play in and of itself. I mean, we talked about black holes and outer space and all sorts of stuff. It was probably three times the length that's in the movie. And there were other scenes of me with William Russ at the beginning talking about my parents and my favorite films being The Third Man and Strangers on the Train and
wow.
all sorts of
yeah.
things that kind of gave you a little bit of a hint of his inner psyche. But none of that, no one knows where that stuff is now. But anyway, I was sure that Al would want to work on the material, to rehearse the big confrontation scene, and to my amazement, he wanted to hang out, but he didn't want to rehearse. It was interesting. He, you know, we were bound together in this movie in a way, you know, we were nemeses of each other, but there was a deep connection in a way, and
right.
he wanted to, also probably knowing that I was a young actor, wanted to just get close and get me to be as relaxed with working with him as possible. So we hung out a lot, and there were scenes that we weren't necessarily in, or that we were in the same space, but we didn't, you know, have dialogue together, like in the clubs, you know, the
mm-hmm.
some of the leather clubs, and we would walk home together from this you know, kind of disorienting experience. Neither of us had ever been in a situation like that, and Friedkin was really wanted to simulate very little. He wanted to actually go, you know, to be happening
right.
In these bars, So it was quite a summer of, whew, you know, wow.
I bet at that time, too.
What did we just live through here? And as you know, there were protests. There was some rioting in the streets of Greenwich Village. There were gay groups that didn't want the movie to be made, and gay groups that thought it was an important movie to be made, a cautionary tale. And there was a lot of security issues. And we would leave these shoots and walk all the way uptown together and just talk and decompress. And we got very, very close. And we didn't rehearse that scene, you know, at all, but we were quite ready to shoot it when we got there. Mm-hmm. And he was tremendously generous, very, very supportive. I mean, when you're working with Al, it's about the artistry, it's about the process. He loves the work, and he wants to bring out the best in anybody he's working with. I'll never forget, there was a night during that scene when we end up in the tunnel, you know?
Yes.
Where he was released because of a turnaround, and he said, I'll be damned if I'm not going to be there for your close-up. So he was off-camera, staying on his own time.
Mm.
It was cold. It was, you know, 4 in the morning. There were mosquitoes. And he was just there to be off-camera for me.
That's very rare, and I've heard from other actors that he does that for them, too, and that's...
This blew my mind. He's off-camera, and there's a weird moment where we're sort of, you don't know whether they're going to, you know, kill each other or fuck or what's going to happen.
Right.
He has his pants off at one point with his leather jacket on, and he said to me, it's a weird image. I'm just going to take the pants off for you. So he was standing there in his boxers with his leather jacket on. He's off camera. He doesn't have to do any of this. But it's a weird, image that he thought might, you know, do something, you know, to me, and he just, it was for me being on camera, and he was released. I will never forget that. I mean,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's the kind of guy he is.
Yeah, I mean, we're very excited. You mentioned Richard III earlier. We have Thomas Waits, who was in that production of Richard III this Sunday night.
Oh, wow.
Speaking of some of that stage experience of Pacino's, but you also worked, I want to get into looking for Richard and Salamaybe.
He called me up and said, Richard, would you meet me at this cafe down in the village? Because we stayed in touch after cruising. It was like climbing a mountain.
Right.
Together to go through that. And we'd read plays together sometimes. He loves to sit around and read plays, and he had this theater loft, he called it, on Broadway and around 20th Street, and we would read various things there. And one day he called up and he said, I want to talk to you about a project. Meet me at this cafe. I said, sure. And lo and behold, there was a cameraman there. This is Richard Leacock. And he filmed some of our conversation down there. I think there was one other person there. But that was the beginning of this amazing odyssey that took years and years and years. And, years later, after we did a lot of the principal photography, called him and said, we've got Spacey's coming over, and Aidan Quinn, you know, is coming over from London or something. We're going to get to shoot the Battle of Bosworth out in Simi Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took a long time, but it was an adventure, as is Salamaybe. And in both cases, if you're really interested in Pacino's process, these are chronicles of his creative process, those
mm-hmm.
films. It's quite extraordinary.
This new box set is probably, for a big Pacino fan like myself, it's probably the most revealing insight into who he is as an artist that we've ever had.
Right.
These films. How is Pacino as a director? I know he said that he doesn't necessarily consider himself a director, but how is his process as a director?
Well, he leaves you alone a lot, and he wants to see what you bring to it, and then he may say a few things that are stimulating, and try this or that. But he's very interested in your instincts, and very, very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
He loves to rehearse. We rehearsed something in Salamaybe. He got an idea that he wanted to explore scenes suggested by David Hare's play Judas Kiss, about the hours before Oscar Wilde was arrested. And
right.
I don't know how much of it will make it into the film, but we shot about 14 pages of it. We rehearsed it for a week. He would rehearse, by the way, after cruising, he did American Buffalo for years, on and off, in different places all over the world. As you know, he loves the theater. He does workshops of things. I mean, I remember going to watch workshops of Brecht's Jungle of Cities and Arturo Uy. I think he worked on Arturo Uy for 6 months and just did one public performance of it.
I know just a couple of years ago he did a performance of
it. He did another production of Arturo Uy, right, that Simon McBurney directed. But he did back, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, he explored Arturo Uy at the Public Theater for 6 months, I believe it was, with actors. Just working in the way that, you know, you may know something about Andre Gregory and how he would work for a year at a time, like on Alice in Wonderland. When he was doing American Buffalo, I visited him in London when he was working on that, and I saw it many times at in New York and at Long Wharf and other places. They would rehearse. Even after they'd worked on this play, after it had been in performance for a year or two, they would get together at 6 o'clock at night, and they would have a cup of coffee together. Sometimes they'd just talk about the day, but other times they'd say, you know, at the end of Act One, you know, I'm sure I once knew why I left, you know, but I want to just think about that again. And they'd talk, and they'd stimulate each other. I remember J.J. Johnson, you know, running out of this rehearsal saying, God, I found something. You know, I just found something new. This is after they'd been performing for a year and a half.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I was so moved by this. I would go down and just sit in the back and watch what they would do. Some nights, as I said, it was just a cup of coffee just to make contact with each other. But other nights it would evolve into real rehearsals. And I was about to work with Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronin on Foxfire, and I asked them if we could get together ahead of time, and Hume looked at me like I was nuts. I said, Laddie, he said, you know, we're old folks, we have our own rituals, and we take a nap and this and that, but if you have the chutzpah to ask us to come in early, he said, what the hell, maybe one night a week we'll do that. And I always felt that the performance was somehow richer that night that we'd come early.
Right. Well, you know, these endless rehearsals and these endless kind of, well, not endless, but these multiple takes that he requests, they really pay off, because in every Pacino performance, there it is filled with such surprising moments.
Absolutely.
That
and
he found in that process.
He loves to mix it up and to try different things. And I remember hearing a story about Frankie and Johnny that were Michelle Pfeiffer, who, like Olivier and certain other actors, comes, you know, apparently with an orchestrated performance to the set. And, you know, they may be very talented, but they come with an idea of exactly
the
moments they want to. Yeah, and Al would try different things on each take. And somebody said that Michelle Pfeiffer would turn to the director and say, look what he's doing. Can he do that? I mean, director said, Gary Marshall said, well, he's doing it. Just go with it. And, you know, I don't know. I didn't see these takes, but a friend of mine was working on post-production on Heat and said that that it was very interesting to see the outtakes that De Niro would, according to this person, you know, improvise a lot, maybe in rehearsal, but once it got to performance, he would be fairly precise, because he wanted to make sure that certain things got on camera.
Yeah.
Whereas Pacino would be very different from take to take, and you know, he'd sing one take, you know, in some odd way in the middle of, and then another way he'd be down, and then he'd be up, and on another take, and he likes to try it a lot of different ways.
Oh, what I wouldn't give to see those outtakes.
Yeah.
We have five actors from Salome maybe actually on Sunday. What can you, is it structured like Looking for Richard? What can you tell us about it?
A little, yeah. It's you know, it springs from the play, from his interest in the play which he saw in London. Who was that great actor that did it in London? Berghoff.
Stephen Berghoff.
Stephen Berghoff did a version that he saw in London that turned him onto the play, I believe, and he then kept reading it and working on it himself. He did it with Marissa Tomei, as I think you probably know in New York and
Cheryl Lee and
yes, right. And he wanted to do it out here, and he wanted to see if it could evolve into a film. And I think in the process of working on it, it became an adventure, like Looking for Richard is, you know, about his passion for Shakespeare and his trying to figure out a way to do it. It's a bit like that in that you see them working on this on the stage performance. You see some of the stage performance. You see them trying to figure out a way to do it as film, and then some of it on film. But it's really about the effort. It's about the process to see what can I do with this extraordinary material. How can I make this accessible to people? And it's a wonderful, wonderful adventure. You know, he goes as he did with Looking for Richard. You know, he went to where they were building the Globe Theater there and whatnot. I mean, he goes to the room that Oscar Wilde died in, and he ruminates about Wilde's life and what he was all about. And it's his love of Oscar Wilde as well as the play.
Right.
And it's the love of creative process. You know. And
I can't wait for it. I personally think that Looking for Richard, I've told you in email, I think it's one of the most stunning movies in his resume.
Wow.
So I can't wait for Salamaybe. But as from an actor's point of view, is there a delineation between when you're performing Shakespeare on the stage and when you're bringing it to screen for a scene in the film?
Well, you mean in terms of the size?
And yeah, in terms of how it is played.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I had dinner once with Pacino and Vanessa Redgrave, and she was talking about the Rose Theater, I think it was, the Swan. And the Rose were the theaters prior to the Old Globe. You know, they were much, much smaller, and they were very intimate. And you all this declamatory, large, you know, Shakespearean souls came in later, you know, pretty much in the 19th century, you know, in the bigger houses. And, of course, the Globe was a lot bigger than the Swan and the Rose. But you can, it's wonderful when you can be very intimate with this on film. And as you remember Looking for Richard, he's almost whispering to himself, "A horse, my kingdom for a horse," you know,
yeah,
bellowing. So that's what's wonderful about the intimacy of film. I think Shakespeare lends itself beautifully to film for that reason.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate having you on, and you just have a fantastic resume. And I it's been an honor to speak with you. What's coming up next for you, other than Salamaybe?
Oh, got a few irons in the fire. I mean, I went to New York to do an interesting film that Emily Hubley directed called The Toe Tactic. And you never know how much of what you did, you know, ends up in the film. I did a very funny scene in Henry Jaglom's Hollywood Dreams that did not end up in the film that he was lamenting about the other day. I just couldn't find a way to, you know, tonally to use it, but I'm dying to see that that footage. You know, I've got a few things floating around, and a few people that had wanted me to do things, like, you know, Milch had talked to me about Deadwood, but then that was canceled. You know, you want to work with great people like Milch and Pacino, and that's what the joy is. And I had a good time in this thing I just did in New York. But you know, give me a holler sometime if you want to talk about anything else. And by then, I'll probably be working on something else.
We'll definitely do
we'll
that.
We'll do that. Thank you so much.
It's always a great pleasure to talk about him and his process, because it's exhilarating working with him. And I wish we could see all the things that he didn't quite get to do, like Hickey, you know, and Modigliani and some of
that. That's right.
Oh, did there's it. A laundry list of things. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And,
fascinating
and,
stuff.
You know, but keep your eyes peeled for the box set. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank
Take
you.
Take care, you guys. Okay.
Take Bye-bye. Care. Bye-bye. All right, Richard Cox.
That was very cool.
A great, great actor, great insight into Pacino as an artist, and so that was fantastic. You guys are going to get a lot more of this Sunday night. We have about 10 guests coming in Sunday night for the two-hour Al Pacino tribute show. It's just going to be fantastic. We're all pumped up about it. So, guys, that's it for today's show.
All right, cool. Great job.
I will talk to you guys later, and we'll talk to everyone out there Sunday night.
Sunday night. Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thanks
bye-bye.
So much, guys. Bye-bye.